that up and support Salida.com and support Salida on Facebook are places to look for links to same. Thanks again for listening. Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others. That was a canceled lecture now off campus. And again, some of my best friends are Zionists. This is the 45-minute video that Bruce Robbins did. I recommend it highly. It's not for faint of heart. It has expletives, again, from Tony Kushner, as well as someone who I don't recognize. I got to go. Thanks for listening, and help support WEFT, Champaign-Urbana, and environs. Hope the signal's getting out to Saybrook. I had a call saying it was fading. We need all the help we can get.
Just not working clear. Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you in here by listener-supported community radio station WFT in Champaign, Illinois, broadcasting at 90.1 FM and webcasting live worldwide at weft.org. Views and opinions expressed here, those of speakers, and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Bob with some of our underwriting announcements.
Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. And the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. And this hour programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, call 217-328-2295. And the Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice, both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Bob. I just want to start off by saying that we're really saddened that Professor Stephen Salida canceled this morning at the last minute due to a family emergency. However, he emphatically stated that he does definitely want to call into the show sometime in the near future. Also, for the second half of the hour, James Kilgore unfortunately had to cancel this morning. However, Brian Dolliner will be in to still talk about the subject at hand. Also, we got a couple of special guests here in the studio right now that we'll introduce here in a moment. Just like a little kind of recap of the week. My wife and I went and saw the film at the Art Theater this Thursday night, Kill the Messenger, dramatization about Gary Webb, the reporter for the San Jose Mercury News, who in the mid-90s broke the story about the CIA helping smuggle cocaine into the United States, in particular Los Angeles, that sort of started the crack cocaine epidemic at that time, in order to fund the Contra terrorists who the U.S. Congress, that the Reagan administration was backing, to try to overthrow the government of Nicaragua at the time, and who the U.S. Congress had cut off funding to when their human rights and terrorist activities were exposed. It's a very, very well done film. Presents real well Gary Webb's sort of ordeal, if you will. First, I mean, he was nominated for a journalist award, and the next thing, he's viciously attacked and his character assassinated by the Washington Post, New York Times, and the L.A. Times. And ultimately, he lost his job as a journalist, couldn't find work, and ended up supposedly killing himself in 2004. I say supposedly because he died of two bullets from a revolver in the head.
Two bullets.
How somebody could do that is a mystery to me. But nevertheless, I don't want to go there. I think we'll just we'll recommend, since the showing was yesterday evening was the last showing at the Art, it's still making its circuit around the country. If you can find another city to watch in, or wait till it comes out on pay-per-view or DVD, but I highly recommend it. It's called Kill the Messenger.
Excellent. Yeah.
Okay, Bob, what do we have as far as news in the week?
Well, I'm going to follow up a little bit more on the Jimmy John story we first talked about
last
week.
One of our favorite people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jimmy John's under fire for worker contracts. And it says here, Jimmy John's doesn't want its low-wage workers to apply for jobs at rivals. And it says, it's one thing for a high-paid exec to be prohibited from working at a competitor, but Jimmy John's actually imposes non-compete clauses on its low-wage workers. So now lawmakers are calling in for an investigation into the sandwich shop's policy of making workers sign contracts that bar them from working for its competition. calling the practice a form of intimidation, House members Representative Joseph Crowley and Representative Linda Sanchez have drafted a letter calling on the Labor Department and the Federal Trade Commission to investigate disturbing reports of the chain's contracts, which are, quoting, inconsistent with trade and labor laws. The letter already has over 30 signatures from other Washington lawmakers. So it says here, too, as the Washington Post first reported last – Huffington Post, I'm sorry – first reported last week that the sandwich chain requires hourly workers to sign non-compete agreements that would prohibit them from working at any other restaurant that sells sandwiches or has a location within 3 miles of Jimmy John's, and that extends for a period of 2 years after they leave their employment at Jimmy John's. It says that these sorts of agreements are commonplace for highly paid top executives or employees who have access to trade secrets, but requiring sandwich makers and delivery drivers to sign such contracts looks more like bullying under color of law, the letter from the lawmaker states. So,
okay,
interesting
good.
Stuff. You can find more information on Huffington Post. They've actually got a PDF document up there of the entire non-compete agreement. So you can go there and read it for yourself. Quite amazing that they would require all employees to sign something like that. And so restrictive, you know, 2 years and within 3 miles of any Jimmy John's sandwich shop.
When you read that story last week, it was like, are you kidding me?
Well,
I mean,
apparently the lawmakers are saying that too right now. Are you kidding me?
Good.
You
know, any heat or discomfort it can cause the owner. What's his real name, by the way, of Jimmy John's?
Jimmy John Leotard.
Anything that can cause him any discomfort, especially knowing he has such a bad temper, this just kind of warms my heart, knowing how he's probably reacting to this, probably throwing temper tantrums.
Well, I mean, it's you know, kind of a reflection of their corporate culture or climate,
yes,
you might call it, or organizational climate.
Yes.
Which would indicate that it's probably not a very good work experience.
Oh, no.
Because one of the reasons is, and I've noticed this from, you know, I work for many, there's times I might work for 12 different companies in a year,
mm-hmm,
you know, on construction. And the differences between the companies are just incredible.
Yeah.
And it's generally a reflection of the who controls the company.
Who manages,
you know,
it.
Right.
Yeah.
And they hire people similar to themselves,
mm-hmm,
you know. And so if you run into a company with a bunch of hard asses, you can bet that the guy who owns the company. And that's another thing, too. Construction companies are relatively flat compared to many other types of businesses.
Flat in what regard?
Well, they don't have a lot of layers of management,
yes,
generally.
Yes, okay.
So that's, I mean, and they're, well, they're, say thing like their slogan, so fast that you'll freak. You know, kind of implies that they're going to have their drivers just speeding all, mm-hmm, over the place, mm-hmm, and so on and so forth.
When the industrial workers of the world were organizing up in Minneapolis, they had a T-shirt that was circulated and sold. It looked like just identical to a Jimmy John's T-shirt that you see the drivers and the sandwich makers wearing. But on the back, instead, the difference was on the back, it said, wages so low, you'll freak.
Oh, well. And now for the real, true, big story of the week.
Yes.
What is it with Renee Zellweger's face?
Who, I don't know who this is.
She's an actress, and
okay,
she had a big movie about 10 years,
uh-huh,
ago. And they keep showing these pictures of her 10 years ago in this movie, comparing them to her now. And,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, she's 10 years older. But it's a big deal. It's a big internet thing. It's a big media thing.
Okay.
It's just bizarre. But what it reflects,
uh-huh,
is the people who own the media,
yeah,
and the culture they're trying to foist on us.
I see where you're going
and
with this. Okay.
And the people they hire who want to report on things like this. I mean, this story is everywhere. In the
this is
media.
Why I don't watch corporate media to a bare bones minimum.
And
yes,
this is internet. I'm not even talking about watching TV. I don't watch.
Oh, this is just
TV
internet.
Yeah,
okay. Wow.
I'm going to dig up those audio clips we had of Jimmy John's talking on another radio station a couple of years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And he had the part where he talked about his dad being a great American and closing his company here in Illinois and moving it down to Mexico and stuff and hiring workers down there. And, okay. you know, kind of the hypocrisy in a statement like that about, mm-hmm. you know, how he is a great American, but yet, you know,
yeah.
closed a factory that was employing American workers here in Illinois and moved it down to Mexico to hire cheaper labor and stuff mm-hmm. like that. So,
yeah, and I've known several people that have worked for Jimmy John's, and it's just an unbelievable, horrible, restrictive, dictatorial, beyond common sense type of work environment. One woman we know that worked there was hired on as a manager, and of course they promised her the sun, the moon, the stars, and they had her working 16 hours a day sometimes, you know, 10, 12 consecutive days. She ended up attempting suicide, I guess, I guess that ended her employment with, you know, but it's just, it's a really bad work environment.
We've reported in the past about NLRB firing or filing charges against Jimmy John's for their union elections and stuff
yes.
up in the Minnesota chain yep. and stuff yep. like that. Mm-hmm. So they're more or less a repeat offender, I would say, you know.
Indeed, indeed. So, okay, we're going to take a quick music break here, and then we will be right back with our guests. So stay tuned. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on Listener Support Community Radio Station WFT in Champaign. We'll be right back.
Seven summits, and I swam the seven seas, but the road I must travel, its end I cannot see. Well, I fought in the jungles, and I fought in the streets, but the road I must travel, its end I cannot see. Well, once I had a reason, don't know what it could be, and the road I must travel, its end I cannot see. Well, I sang to myself that I want to be free, but the road I must travel, its end I cannot see. I walked the empty desert and was burned in the heat, but the road I must travel, its end I cannot see. Well, I crossed the frozen wasteland, in the bitter cold did freeze, and the road I must travel, its end I cannot see. And I will knock on every door, for I do not have a key, and the road I must travel, its end I cannot see. Well, I sang to myself that I wanna be free, but the road I must travel, its end I cannot see. They shot a man in Soho, couldn't guess his age. I found his empty journal, I filled up every page. I called up my state senator, they said he wasn't there. The secretary took my name, and man, she sounded scared. So I counted my misfortunes, I added up the blame.
Okay, we're back. That was Tom Morello on The Road I Must Travel, off his Night Watchman CD. And so now at this point, I'd like to introduce our guests. Guests, would you like to introduce yourselves?
Sure. Hi, I'm Heidi Grove.
And I'm David Grove.
Okay, and you want to tell us a little about yourself?
Sure. We are residents of Champaign, have been for a very long time. Both very, I would say, socially minded people. We've made that pretty much our careers through working in case management. I've also worked in AmeriCorps. I was an AmeriCorps member and also served as a supervisor in one of the programs that used to exist in this area, and am currently a school social worker.
And you also just recently won the State Social Worker of the Year Award?
Yes, I did.
Okay, well, congratulations.
And I'm David Grove. Moved to Urbana Champaign in 1971, then moved to Urbana. I'm very glad to be here on the Labor Hour. I have had many entry-level jobs and was a outreach social worker for 15 years as an at-will employee, and I work for a local school district where it was the first time where I had labor protections. So I'm glad to be here on the Labor
Hour. Yeah, so both of you are represented by the IEA Teachers and Support Staff Union?
I'm represented by the support staff union. Mm-hmm. Heidi's represented by the teachers union.
Okay. I wasn't sure social workers fell into the teachers' realm of that or the support staff, so, but that makes sense. Okay, well, you know, I wanted to invite you on the show because you guys recently went down to Ferguson, Missouri.
We did.
Okay, let's hear what your experiences were like down there.
So we actually went down that first weekend in August. So the shooting was on August 9th, I think. And so that first weekend, we just woke up that Saturday and I said to David, I feel just really compelled to go. So we just spontaneously decided to drive down to Ferguson. We didn't have a plan. We did a little bit of web research.
Okay.
Where protests were.
You didn't have a contact down there, a person that you knew?
No, we didn't have a contact.
Okay.
We don't have anybody that we know.
That's pretty brave, actually. Yeah. I mean, going into a situation like that with without a contact person of some sort, you know?
Yeah, we on the way down thought we just didn't know quite what to expect, but that we would get off the interstate at the Ferguson exit, drive around, you know, do a little research. It's not a very big town. Reminds me a lot of Urbana.
Okay.
So, we didn't really have a set goal or a plan other than we just wanted to kind of be there to show our support. I mean, mm-hmm. We feel kind of like it's our cousin city in a lot of ways because it's so close.
And this was during the time period when the nightly news was showing fairly horrific pictures of the crowd and police interactions. And so besides your regular white middle class guilt about maybe participating in something like this, it was I think there was some concern about what it was going to be like. But we just got off the highway, used Google Maps, and as it turns out, we ended up across from the police station at what I would call
The point. Would that be Ground Zero?
No. Actually, it wasn't. Ground Zero was actually on the main commercial drag.
Okay.
We were on the old, what I would describe as the River Railroad.
Okay.
That goes through St. Louis, and we saw a protest. It turns out, I would guess that they were all local and regional religious leaders who mm-hmm. were having the protest. Almost everybody there was middle-aged
mm-hmm.
or older, and they completely dispelled any notion we might have had of you're not welcome. It was a very open, welcoming experience. There were maybe 30, 35 people, and they rotated in and out.
Okay. I had a friend from Oakland, California that went there. Sounds like it was quite close to the time frame you went there, and he stayed for like about 3 days or so, 3 nights. And what he was really surprised about, I mean, he saw a lot of ministers there, some that were as he put it, some were being very conducive to trying to get justice for Michael Brown. Others seemed like more they were trying to co-opt and distract the protesters, almost like he said, almost like they were working for the police. But he said he was really surprised about the number of young people he saw out protesting at night. I mean, that was maybe the difference was is that more of your older crowd came did the day protests, and then the youth came out at night. Would you say maybe that might be the case? Did you stay overnight or?
We didn't. We drove down and we stayed the day. Basically, we stayed at that location for a few hours mm-hmm. and then drove back. But you know, I agree, and I think we just decided it looks like this was the protest that would be good for us to mm-hmm. stop at, or mm-hmm. it was the first one we saw. So we just stopped. And, you know, it like you said, we didn't know anyone,
mm-hmm.
Didn't have a contact, and we're kind of seasoned protesters.
Uh-huh.
And so I think the thing that was most life-changing for me was just the raw emotion of it all, because it was right after the shooting had happened. There were so many unanswered questions, as there still continue to be. But there was so much raw emotion. But the thing that I saw was more of this outpouring of, we're a community, we're in it together, we're here to help each other out. And the hard part after being there and coming back after that was not ever seeing that represented really very truthfully in the media.
Okay, in the corporate media. Okay. Were the police out in force when you were there?
The police were not out. They would drive by. You could tell they were going, my guess was because they were driving towards where the bigger protest was.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably where they were. The everyone in the group that we were in were respectful. There really wasn't anybody trying to, you know, bait anybody else. Mm-hmm. Some of the officers would drive by and wave. And at times you kind of wondered, was it genuine or was it not? I think from a couple of them, it was, though.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. I think one of the things that happened while we were there was a family had just had a funeral and they had a lot of leftover food, and they were being escorted by what I would just guess was probably like the Hell's Angels. Yeah, to come into the parking lot and dropped off just a whole bunch of food. Thanks for being here. We want to support you.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah. And then they actually left and drove over to the police station and went inside. Don't know what the result of that was.
Okay.
And then left as well. And David, you're right. There were a lot of middle-aged people there, but there were also families with kids there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a pretty mixed group of people from different backgrounds, different ethnicities, mm-hmm. Some different ages. And the message was just about, you know, justice, not about who's right, who's wrong, but what the truth is,
mm-hmm.
and about peace. You know, little kids holding signs saying, put down guns, take care of my education.
Well, which, that's a good sign, you know, yeah. So yeah. At this time, were the police making everybody walk? And I mean, because I heard that there was just a court ruling saying the police couldn't do that, because for a while I understand that the police were making all protesters keep moving. In other words, you had to keep walking. You couldn't stand in one location.
I think where we were was a little different.
Okay.
And there was a business which had allowed this.
Okay.
Again, I believe religiously organized protest to occur. And I think it was the most welcoming part came apart about as something very strange. Obviously intoxicated and very upset individual threw a water bottle into the street and said something about bleepity bleep Metro West, which I guess is part of the St. Louis police force. And man, the mama bear came out. And she was very peaceful. She was very kind. But she made sure this person paid attention to her and said, I want you to understand that's not what we're about here. We are about just standing up for justice mm-hmm. and peace and love. And then we all had a big group hug session. And so this was maybe 15 minutes after we arrived. And so all of a sudden we're all hugging each other and introducing each other.
Mm-hmm.
And people, of course, asked where we were from, and we said that, you know, we had come down from Champaign. There was also a gentleman from Maryland. But most of the people there were local, and being on this very old highway, the river road, I would guess, that runs through St. Louis, the number of people just acknowledging that we were there was incredible. Every car going by pretty much mm-hmm. honked at us. There was one individual who stopped and said, hey, you all go home, you don't belong here. But yeah. The vast majority of people were supportive, and the community is an amazing community. It is a quaint, attractive little community that I would have felt very comfortable growing up in. It's very different from what support was being portrayed on the media.
Okay. All right. Brian Dolliner has joined us here in the studio. We're going to take another quick music break here, and then we're going to be right back with some public service announcements and have Brian, kind of everybody join into a little some topics that Brian has brought to us. And it kind of relates to Ferguson, of course. And so we'll just take it from there and see where it goes. So anyway, you're listening to the World Labor Hour on the Supporting Community Radio Station W. Teen Champagne. Stay tuned. We will be right back.
Miller kept the Senior Citizen Center for a long time up there in Seattle, Washington. Jack had spent most of his life in the forest as a logger or timber beast, they called him in those days, because you were treated like an animal. There were no bunkhouses. You were called sleeping on the ground with his fellow workers with their wet clothes from the rainforest piled in a heap next to the fire, hoping that they would be dry by the time to go to work the next day. They spoke many different languages in the forest, and they could hardly talk to each other. It was just like Lawrence. He said most of them had never been to school. Most of them couldn't read or write. Jack Miller could remember the Verona. There was a shingle weaver strike up at Everett, Washington, called the Everett Massacre. It's another one of those that didn't make it into the history books. The Wobblies, they chartered a steam launch called the Verona, and they had it sailed up there to Everett, bringing strike relief. And as the boat sailed into the pier, Sheriff McRae had ringed the whole pier with armed deputies. He just deputized every drunk in every bar in town and put a rifle in their hand. Well, they surrounded the boat, and when they lowered the gangplank, Sheriff McRae walked to the end of it and said, "Who are your leaders here?" And they shouted back with one voice, "We are all leaders here." Well, that scared the tar out of the law, you know, and they began shooting. Those deputies began shooting. A lot of those Wobblies were killed. Some of the deputies were killed in the crossfire, though. So when the Wobblies and those that survived made it back to Seattle, they were arrested. And they were thrown in the Snohomish County Jail on a charge of murder. A whole bunch of them. Well, that jail was an all-steel jail. It was the newest affair, all made out of steel. It had just barely opened, so the heat wasn't on, and there was no blankets, and you couldn't get any smokes. So those Wobblies, they passed a note from one cell block to the other. And then by common consent, the next day, they were all gathered in the middle of each cell block. And when the noon whistle blew, they began to jump up and down simultaneously. Up and down, singing all the time. And finally they hit the resonating frequency of that jail and cracked the south wall. They broke the jail. And Jack Miller said, thus proving everlastingly what a union is. A way to get things done together that you can't get done alone. Now, Jack said, you know, we didn't have any intellectual life. We lived in our emotions. We were passionate people. And we were comfortable in our emotions. We made commitments to struggle emotionally, commitments for which there are no words. But those commitments carried us through 50, 60 years of struggle. He said, you show me people who make the same commitments intellectually, and I don't know where they'll be next week. Kind of stern, isn't it? Well, he said, armed only with our sense of degradation as human beings, we came together and organized and changed the condition of our lives. Now, this is the hard thing, he said. Why can't you young people, with all you've got, do the same thing?
Okay, we're back. World Labor Hour. You just heard Utah Phillips and Annie DeFranco. And that song was Fellow Workers CD, and that was Why Come. And anyway, we've been joined by Brian Doliner in the studio. Brian, welcome back to World Labor Hour.
Hey, Dave. Thanks for the invite. Good morning, everybody out there in Radio Land.
Okay, so we invite you on the show to kind of talk about a similar sort of issue that's kind of related to Ferguson, actually. But this is dealing with locally here, so have at it.
Well, yeah, you know, Ferguson is having such major repercussions for us doing this work, trying to monitor, bring more accountability to the police and stop these police killings of black youth. For those of us doing this work, this is, you know, this is having such great reverberations in our own community. You know, I was talking to my friend and longtime activist in Champaign-Urbana, Terry Townsend, and Terry, who's been to Ferguson, and Ferguson, and Terry says, you know, I'm just, I hate to say this, but I'm just so happy that Ferguson happened, you know. of course, we're not happy to see about, you know, these
yes.
youth being gunned down in the streets. But, you know, people stepping up and taking a stand for this is what is especially significant, because we know that black youth are being gunned down in the streets, whether in Champaign or Chicago or L.A. or New York or in Ferguson. But what's unique here is that the community is standing up. And so this is setting a major precedent, and we know these things are building. We all been watching what happened with Oscar Grant or Trayvon Martin or other cases. And so we've been seeing this movement building against these police killings. So we, you know, have been monitoring. You know, we continue to monitor and watch what the police are going on, what they're doing around town. And there was news earlier in the year that the Champaign County Sheriff Dan Walsh had acquired a MRAP. This is mine-resistant, ambush-protected vehicle, straight from the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. These were developed about 5, 6, 7 years ago for withstanding mine blasts. And, you know, the stories came out about the Hummers not having any armor, so they had contracts for billions of dollars of these MRAPs that they sent overseas and drove them around. And now that the wars have been scaled back, they don't need them anymore. So now the Department of Defense is offloading them onto our local police departments. Some 500-600 police departments have acquired these gigantic, these are 25-ton trucks, massive things. And what we see, what we saw in Ferguson with the police going around and setting up barricades with these armored trucks, pulling out M16 assault rifles and in full military gear, coming out on peaceful protesters. You know, this people were alarmed when they saw those images, and so now we're taking more interest, I think, in how this is being, how this equipment's being distributed at a very sort of quiet and a very simple and forthright manner throughout these departments. This has been going on. It's only now that we are sort of alerted to this issue. So I wrote a story about the MRAP that the sheriff acquired and its plans for its use, which is basically going to be used with the SWAT team to take the place of, they already have one armored car, and they have a armored personnel carrier. They have two trucks that they use with their SWAT team. Champaign police have their own SWAT team, and the city police do in Champaign, and they've got their own truck and their own SWAT team. So here we have three of these trucks already in town, and it is these smaller models that you saw in Ferguson, what are called Bearcats. But what we have is like twice that size, at least, with six wheels, the MRAP. And so the sheriff is currently getting it a paint job and getting it fully outfitted. And I have not heard, to my knowledge, that it's hit the streets yet, but it's soon to hit the streets. And we know it's going to be used with the SWAT team. And the News Gazette, it took them some time, but they finally caught wind of the story and did a report and found out themselves that the SWAT raids that are conducted by the department, between 65% and 80% of them are done to serve warrants. And most of those are for drug warrants. You know, they're not for armed shooters at the local high school. There are these very, you know, they go on about at least once a month or once every other week. They're jumping up in people's houses looking for, most often, small amounts of drugs. Mm-hmm. And most often, information based on, you know, people snitching mm-hmm. on one another, unreliable information. This is what the MRAP is going to be used for. You know, the police say it's going to be used for digging people out of snow during wintertime.
Oh, please.
This massive thing. Actually, I've heard other people say that in their towns they've seen these things get stuck in the mud. They're so large and heavy.
Yeah, just Google six-wheel MRAP.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this thing is.
They're massive.
Yeah, I mean.
You know, what does this say about our society in general? I mean, you know, I mean, it's like the. There's not exactly, how should I put it, a compelling need for this. I mean, it sounds like overkill at best, but I mean, it's almost like nationwide. I mean, of course, it's not every community, but in general, there seems to be a trend nationwide of militarizing the police, of excessive uses of force, and you compound all this with various. I just got some interesting data here about the cities of Philadelphia and New York City. Philadelphia over the last 3 years has been having over $40 million in settlements. From 600 different misconduct lawsuits, everything from shootings, beatings, what have you. New York City, $500 million since 2009, and it's almost like the it's almost like the 1% in this country are encouraging the police to do this. Almost like they're trying to, as if they're expecting something a huge social upheaval nationwide, or they're trying to basically send a message of intimidation. Don't you, you know, trying to have a chilling effect on people coming out for peaceful protests? What's all of your opinions on this? Well, am I off the wall here? Or am I reading too much into this or not?
No, I'd like to say, in fact, I believe it's bad policing. And this just goes to my own personal experience. 10 years as a mental health outreach caseworker, 3 years domestic violence, and 2 years of crisis counseling. When you work with police officers in the street and the community, I have seen some amazing social work conducted by people who are police officers. I mean, their ability to not hide behind a armored vehicle, to be vulnerable, to walk up there with respect and calm demeanor, very peaceful, and just listen to people and converse with people. That is truly at the heart of policing. And I've also seen in the schools, I know it's a huge topic here in Champaign-Urbana having SROs, but I worked at one of the local junior highs, middle school. And there were some real gangbangers at this one. And what's funny is they were the ones you could get along with because they knew who they were. But the SRO in that building was very good at establishing relationships. It was not about a power trip.
I'm going to ask you a question. What is this term resource officer? I mean,
SRO stands for school resource officer.
That's what I mean. What? Mm-hmm. It's not a, how are they a resource? You know, there's security.
Yeah.
Why is that? What I'm just wondering.
About the terminology,
yeah. Yeah.
I think.
To cover up, sort of, or.
Well,
I think that the intent of having someone there who can be there to be an ally to kids and educate kids, like the police officer who was able to come into health class, especially when it comes to topics of violence and bullying and safety. But I think the truth of the matter is that's not always going to be the case. And I, like David, have seen officers, especially beat cops, who are really good at conflict resolution. And I've also seen people who are absolutely the opposite of that. So much of it, I think, is really based on who you are as a person and why you decided to get in the profession in the first place is really
okay.
The key.
But this,
well, yeah, something I want to point out is that, especially, I believe, since World War II, and much of the police, it's almost a prerequisite to serve in the military to be a police officer. At least they have a huge advantage. And I don't know what the percentages are, but I think a huge number of people. Well, a mutual friend of ours, Dan Carpenter, his father was the police officer in B-Mint, and he was like a special forces kind of ranger guy. You know, so he was definitely not.
So, Brian, what's your take on all this? I mean, go back into my original question. What's the point of getting overkill militarization of police? I mean, what do you think's behind it?
Well, there's large profiteers, people who are making this equipment, who are making money and funding lobbyists to influence politicians. But then I think there's also a latent knowledge and awareness of a huge segment of the working class that has totally been cast aside, and a large portion of the U.S. working class, which is unemployed, on the streets, wandering from house to house, and ripe for, urban uprising. And this is what we see in Ferguson, a huge segment of the black working class totally with no real way of getting out of their position, a few jobs in the community, food, being a food desert, you know, this. So people are just totally cast aside and in the society, and I think the folks, the ruling class, knows that they are out there, and at the smallest spark could be set off. So I think. You know, while ostensibly the purpose of the police, and I think what they do on a daily basis, is deal with conflicts, drug cases that they, and certainly larger incidents of violence. But this is ultimately, I think, what this kind of equipment is laying around for. You know, here in Champaign County, the police have access to about 100 assault rifles that are provided by this Department of Defense program, the program 1033. And the Champaign police themselves have 24 M16s. What happens when their SROs get a M16 in their hands on school premises? You know, this could be very alarming. So we're trying to establish some basic policy to say that this equipment shouldn't be used on minors, that it shouldn't be used against peaceful protesters, and that I don't believe it should be used to carry out routine drug warrants. And so we're trying to form a coalition of folks who can accept some of these basic premises and ask for some guidelines if the departments are going to have this equipment.
Okay.
So I think, you know, for me, the meat of the matter is this idea of trauma and how many of our kids and our families are traumatized every day. And I absolutely agree with you. Re-traumatizing kids by having those weapons in school is the exact opposite of what is going to be healthy for them. And so you have a group of people who are already completely disenfranchised in so many different ways, and then you have to be re-victimized by that, in that sense that, you know, the trauma is there, and we don't societally acknowledge the power and the importance of that.
Well, I was think something too, what you're saying made me think, maybe we're just getting these kids used to being police.
Mm-hmm.
They're being trained that way to
accept
be
it.
Used to having an armed, uniform police officer around all the time.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's almost like the military industrial complex meets the prison industrial complex here.
School industrial complex.
School to prison, yeah. We're going to take a real quick music school break here, and we are going to come right back, and stay tuned.
It's for the broken, battle hymns for the misled. Battle hymns for the wretched, the forgotten and the dead. Battle hymns of redemption, of solidarity and pride. Battle hymns we will be singing at the turning of the tide. Mothers and the fathers of those who come riding home in coffins in their military clothes, shiny medals pinned to their dead teenage chests while the trumpets blare. And you lie your best, so ask all you want from the dusk till the dawn. The answer's still no. Battle hymns for the broken, battle hymns for the misled, battle hymns for the wretched, the forgotten and the dead. Battle hymns of redemption, of solidarity and pride. Battle hymns we will be singing at the turning of the tide. Blaine away the sleight of hand and the criminality of spending souls for oil. Well, in the mirror I can see I am the path that leads down. I am the dark and bloody hall. I'm the reaper, executioner, hangman, judge and the law. So tie a yellow ribbon round the oak tree on the lawn. But the cavalry's not coming, brother, they're gone. Battle hymns for the broken,
battle hymns for the misled, battle hymns for the wretched, the forgotten and the dead, battle hymns of redemption, of solidarity and pride, battle hymns we will be singing at the turning of the tide. So I'm sharpening my shovel, I'm firing the kiln, I'm blind and I am purposeful, a martyr on the hill.
Okay, we're back, the World Labor Hour, and we're here with some guests, Brian Doliner and Heidi and David Grove, and we're going to continue this conversation on the militarization of police. But first, some public service announcements. Another sports show with host fellow worker Neil Parthen on 104.5 FM WRFU this Saturday and every Saturday from 2 to 3 p.m. And then Labor's Worldview TV this Sunday and every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. on Comcast Channel 6 and live at www.urbanapublictelevision.org. This Sunday was going to be an interview with Professor Stephen Salida, followed by a Labor Beat 30-minute film with Stephen Salida at the University of Chicago. So this Sunday, it will be just the Labor 30-minute Labor Beat film. We will be getting Stephen Salida back both here on World Labor Hour and Labor's Worldview TV in the future. But also let you know on Labor's Worldview TV, 1 week from this coming Sunday, on Sunday, November 2nd, we'll air an interview from 4 to 5 p.m. with State Representative candidate Carol Ammons. So tune in and be informed about issues that affect our lives. Sundays, 4 to 5 p.m. on Comcast Channel 6 and live at our www.urbanapublictelevision.org. So, okay, coming back, we've got about 10 minutes here left. And so, David and Heidi, so some more thoughts on this issue about militarization, especially from the perspective of the schools.
Without going into my history, I think America, while it pretends to be class blind, is a class structured society. And I was not raised by socialist parents, but that sure sounds like a socialist message. What I want to remind people is that all of our students in education and all of our community members, they're just other people. These are our children. These are our brothers, our sisters, our parents, and that we all need to remember that, where our society has become so crazy divisive. I wasn't alive during the McCarthy era, but it sure seems like it's come back in some ways, and we all need to just break that down and just remember we're all people, and there's to stop using these labels like monster and thug and, you know, charging children as adults, I personally believe is wrong. There's a case recently with a, I think it was a 12 or 13-year-old who's being charged as an adult. And that's just, that's wrong. That's disrespectful to life. So that's all I have to say.
Well, and I think, too, is to just be aware of what, you know, your own personal biases are and what your own background is and how that informs, you know, what you choose to do and how you think and what you can do to challenge yourself to change it, because you really are the person who can begin to make the change. And if you want to see change in the world, you have to be that person who is willing to take the first step and take a really hard look at yourself and make a change. And I agree with David that, you know, kids are kids. Just because you have a perception about what you think one person might be, kids, a nine-year-old's a nine-year-old and deserves all the rights and opportunities and those privileges just to be a nine-year-old, and not to have to carry the load that so many of our little kids have to carry every day. And just the amazing resiliency that they have, that they can live through things that would kill me in a heartbeat. And for that, I completely admire them and their families.
Not to, you know, I'm afraid to open this almost like opening a can of worms here, because this could be a whole program. But, you know, it's interesting to look, compare the United States to other industrialized countries, and to look at, you know, how this is, you know, in no other industrialized country do we have the amount of police killings, the amount of people in jail on a per capita basis or any of that. And also going back to the schools, what you have to deal with and what teachers have to deal with on a daily basis, how much does poverty play into this? I mean, all those factors that create a lot of the problems. I mean, everything from kids not being able to do well to all sorts of other things that kids are being exposed to in their homes, on the streets, in the neighborhoods they live as a result of poverty. Which is, you know, it breeds crime, of course.
Exactly. And people are just trying to survive to live every day. And, mm-hmm. you know, each of us has to do our part to live. And that's, you know, what you have to do is, it can be really heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, when you think about fair, it's not fair at all.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. I think the militarization just of our entire country, I mean, that's just our history in so many ways. And so if we want it to be different and we want things to be different, we have to change it.
Okay.
Well, Dave, what I want to say, I want to get back to a cultural thing.
Yes.
All right. And in a culture, for one thing, it is not really our heritage of militarization. In fact, the founders were very wary of military.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
involvements, foreign military involvements, yeah.
They feared that the military would turn into what the police are now,
mm-hmm.
in many ways. And also, you know, this in a culture, it's like a fish. It stinks from the head down.
Mm-hmm.
And this culture has been dominated for the last 30 years by conservatives and conservatism.
I would disagree with that, Bill.
It has.
They're not conservatives. I mean, a lot of these people are right-wing.
No, Dave, they're Hobbesian conservatives.
Okay.
Life is hard. It's terrible. You know, people need to be controlled. That's classic conservatism, not just traditionalism. It is. People need to be controlled. It goes back to, you know, several philosophers.
Okay.
Yeah, and sorry I'm kind of spaced out today, folks, but my work schedule's been really rough lately.
No, this is a good point, Bill.
Yeah, I'm not expressing it as well as I'd like to, but I really think, I mean, you go back, and it's been...
So what's happened in the last 30 years has accelerated this, or...
Yeah, whatever. Since the backlash in the 1970s, of course, World War II might have had a big part of it. You know, that's when we really started having the standing army in the Cold War, and there was a backlash against that in the 60s, then there was a re-backlash in the 70s, largely fueled by strategic actions of very wealthy people and corporations along the lines of the Lewis Powell memo,
mm-hmm.
you know, and
basically there's too much democracy.
Yes. And we're mm-hmm. reaping that now. On top of that, there are several ways that our civilization can collapse right now. We're teetering on many brinks, you know, ecological, economic,
political.
And energy, mm-hmm. and political too. And that's really scary for these people, and they want to make sure that they can clamp down.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and we're going to let you finish up here, Brian.
Well, you know, it's right on. You know, we are the most militarized society on the planet, and we have, again, the largest incarcerated population on the planet.
So you think the two tie in, these wars abroad, the quote-unquote war on terror, maybe I was right the first time, and what's happening here in the States? I mean, is there a correlation?
Sure. The war is coming home, and in the case of this military equipment, these are some of the best examples. So, you know, I just wanted to mention before we go three campaigns I'm involved with. One, this effort to demilitarize the police, and we're talking to labor organizations and religious organizations, civil rights organizations around town to form a coalition. And take our appeals to city councils, to school boards, and the county board. But we are also waging a campaign to stop this ongoing train that is moving towards building a new jail in our community. We already got two jails, and now they want even bigger one of the two jails. And so we were just at the county board this week and had several people speak up very powerfully about the need to address mental illness for people in the jail, and that people need community services, not an isolation box and a turtle suit keeping them strapped down.
Yeah, is it true that if you've got money and or a very good insurance policy, that if there's mental health issues, you go to the Carl Pavilion? If you're poor and or have no insurance, you go to the jail, and they, as you said, put you in isolation in a turtle suit.
Right, which is the only real public services mm-hmm. that we have anymore.
So you're
that
saying
are accessible.
That there needs to be some kind of a mental health facility built instead of a jail as possible alternative.
That's what we're proposing. And
okay.
The police and the authorities always seems to have all kinds of money when it comes for this military equipment or for a new jail, but mm-hmm. when it comes to provide the services that are tried and tested and true, we seem to be coming up short.
Well, that's on the national level, too.
Yes.
Yeah. Sure, sure. And so the third campaign.